and welcome to Season 4, Episode 5 of the Shelleybrook MP Team Podcast. You're here with me, Mr. Southwell. Mr. Doyle, good morning.
Good morning, everybody.
Mr. Nash, good morning.
Good morning. How are we all right?
And Mr. Tierney's back with us again. How are you?
Good morning. Oh, I'm good, thank you.
And we've got, by popular demand, Miss Green's joined us as well. How are you?
Good morning. I'm good, thanks.
So, we're in lockdown. We've had a bit of news this week about potentially coming back to work. How's everybody been?
It's been good. It's been interesting. The weather's been up and down this week. So we've been doing a little bit more indoor stuff. Balloon badminton went well until the balloon popped this morning inside. But the weather's brightened up today, so hopefully we'll be able to get back out and about again.
What about you, Mr. Tierney?
Yeah, not too bad. I've actually taken up running since the start of May. I set myself a challenge to run 50k across the whole of May, and I can tell you that it's very painful starting off. So trying to get over the aches and pains is what I'm doing at the minute.
So you're not sat in a nice bath at the moment?
No.
What about you, Miss Green?
Yeah, all right. I've managed to get my whole hands on a spin bike and some weights. So that's been quite nice because I was running a lot, but the knees getting old weren't particularly enjoying that. So that's been nice to mix it up a bit and keep active.
That's been good. And then Mr. Nash?
I am never going to go running, and I don't care how long we're in lockdown, I will never start running. So the fact that Mr. Tierney has taken running on, I'm very proud of him. I think that's brilliant. I think this is the first week in lockdown where I've been really cooped up. I've been very busy with work and things, and so it's been a bit of a tough week. But hey, living the dream as always.
It's one of those, it's starting to feel a bit more like there's a little bit more freedom coming, obviously. I was back on the golf course, which I plan to be every day now until the end of time. And then you've also got live sport this weekend, so I imagine everyone's tuning in tomorrow for the Bundesliga tomorrow morning. Even Mr. Nash.
Come on, Borussia Dortmund.
Yeah, our resident football expert will be tuning in as well, no doubt.
Of course.
Do you know who's playing?
Two football teams.
Is this the time where we donate Bayern Munich to Mr. Nash so he can actually win something with the football team?
Yeah, that'd be a good sign.
Could we assign in Munich?
That'd be quite a good one. That's a good sign. But yeah, live sports return. There's a couple of more events on. There's some live golf on, but that's over in America. And I think the week after that, there's a couple more sports returning as well. So we're starting to see it happening. It's all going to look very different. A bit concerned about when we might actually get to watch an event again.
Yeah, and I guess even now they're playing live sport in your homes, it's still going to be quite odd because you're used to getting together with friends to watch it, so you're still going to have that difference as well.
I think everything's going to look a bit different in sport, and it's just getting used to how that's going to look come a few weeks, a few months, whatever it might be. On the agenda today, we're going to look a little bit at choking in sport, which I think Mr. Doyle wants to look at as well. And we're going to look a bit about financial control as well, so just how money's coming into sport in different formats, in different ways, really. But obviously, because we've got a new guest, we're going to ask Miss Green our three questions that we ask every new guest. Are you ready, Miss Green?
Ready and raring.
Right, what's your favourite moment in sport?
I think it's probably when Johnny Wilkinson drop-kicked the goal in the World Cup in 2003. Just because I can remember probably one of my earliest memories of watching sport and getting that kind of real buzz and passion and joy from it, if that makes sense, kind of what it's all about to watch it. So, yeah, I'd say that's probably one of my favourites.
That's mad. Everybody was up at like 9 in the morning watching that as well. It was really early, wasn't it? What about your role model? Who's your role model in sport?
It was always Kelly Smith, younger. Obviously, as a footballer, female footballer, thankfully now times have changed so much and it's much more accessible to girls, and it's so good every year watching the new Year 7s come up with more and more girls wanting to play football and being already involved in football. But when I was younger and at school, it wasn't really the done thing. There wasn't particularly much teams, etc. on offer for it. But Kelly Smith was obviously the main woman, female in football. She went over to America, did all the scholarships, played professionally, came back over, played for Arsenal, did the quadruple with Arsenal and things like that. So I'd say she was the main role model to say, actually, females can do it. And now, fortunately, there's so many more for younger people to kind of look towards.
And then the last one is, if you've got to perform one skill to save the world, what would it be?
Yeah, I'm a bit worried about the world right now. I would have, if you think about back in the day, I'd probably say a netball shot or a good reverse hit in rounders, smacking it over first base. However, now I'm probably a bit rusty and I'd probably go for something a bit more safe, like a racing dive, which I could probably still manage quite well in order to save everyone.
I like that. We've got a bit of a mixture every week. That's been good. What we want to look at for Mr. Doyle?
Miss Green, your role model, I was really interested. Has the country, the world, done enough yet in terms of female sport? You say there's more kids coming in every single year in football in particular. That's really, really good. But like, for somebody who's in sport and has been in sport as a female, do you think that there's still more to do, or are we on the right track?
I think we're definitely on the right track. I think, unfortunately, women's sport isn't as popular as men's sport, so you don't get the money, you don't, in certain aspects, you don't get the money, and obviously everything is supply and demand. But I think we're definitely on the right track with much more, social media, I think, has helped women's sport huge, so you can kind of follow Instagram accounts and see what's going on with football at the weekends. They're now played on telly, you can now stay on after match of the day and watch the women's highlights. Obviously finals, big games are showed on BBC and everything like that. So I definitely think we're going in the right track. It's just about now more people picking it up and it becoming more wanted for it to continue growing.
Can I just say, I thought, you know, Mr. Bill's question was brilliant, but my only point from listening to your whole chat screen was the fact that your greatest sport at the moment was not represented in the Bachelors rugby team. So I'm actually gutted.
It was a close second, Mr. Nash. That wooden spoon will forever be in my heart.
Good, that's all right then.
Right, we're going to go into two topics though. First one's about a bit like financial control in sport, and obviously we've got a bit of a range of sort of sporting backgrounds, which is good. Where do you all sit on the idea of financial control and how it's influenced in different sports?
It's playing a huge part at the moment in the decisions, isn't it? There are some footballers in particular out there who are saying that they shouldn't even be thinking about playing professional sport at the moment. And the only reason they are is because of the money involved in the game. And I suppose that's been a theme over the past sort of 20 years since maybe 1992, Premier League came in, all that money started getting invested by the TV companies. You know, it's a really, really good case in point, but there is almost far too much. If you look also in Formula One at the moment, they're almost saying, is it worth racing? Because the money that's involved from the sponsorship, and actually they're not being the crowds, and maybe they're not being the TV viewers because of that, they're almost saying, is there a point in going over and spending all the money on the cars and all the money on the parts? Is there a point in racing? Has it got to the stage where actually, if the money isn't good enough, is there a point in doing a sport? Has it gone too far?
I think that's one way definitely of looking at it, and I think you've got other things as well where the money in sport is dictating what goes on, and you've also got the idea now of sports sort of and teams breaking rules, and this is quite common in rugby at the moment. Have you seen the story about Saracens this season?
Yeah, so I think what's gone on with them is quite interesting, really, in that they have been really successful in the last couple of years, winning the Premiership, winning the European Cup. And as a whole, the Premiership last season, the Rugby Premiership, they lost a combined £50 million. So all of the teams in that league are losing money. And Saracens were the only team in the sense to kind of gain success, despite with an owner who's happy to lose that money kind of thing. They were going, they're finding ways around it to achieve that success. Don't get me wrong, but a lot of the other teams were also running at a deficit. The only team to actually been in the black positive was Exeter. Everyone else in the league lost money, but Saracens were the team who essentially went around that and around the rules to go beyond that. And why I find it really interesting with this is because of their success, they've produced loads of England players, they've made a new stadium, they play a brilliant brand of rugby that's been successful. What cost do we have on that? Do we see it maybe as a good thing?
So is that cheating then? And then who's at fault if it is? Because the owners have obviously taken a decision to overpay the players and go against the financial regulations. but whose fault is that? Do you say that it's the player's fault for taking the money? I mean, if someone offered me a contract, I'd just take it. I wouldn't expect to consider the financial side.
I'd say it's probably down to the clubs. They're the ones that are making the decision. They know what the rules are in place, whether they agree with it or disagree with it. If that rule's been put in place, they need to work by it. And if they're offering their players more money, like you say, yeah, okay, the player has some responsibility to turn around and go, I don't think I can be paid that much. But if the club is pushing the contract on them and saying, no, we want you to take this, we're making this available to you, then it's got to be the club's, you know, responsibility and issue.
That's a good shout. Mr. Nash, I think you had a point as well.
I think I agree with what the screen was saying. Ultimately, it's got to fall on the club for that responsibility. And a lot of these, you hear a lot of stories about some of these financial gains that players were getting. We're also not necessarily straight up money, but money in different ways. So, you know, I might be revamping my house, but the club owner will be able to pay me £1 million to revamp that house and give me that money. But then the house is yours at the end. So there's other ways to get around it. That's what they've experimented with to try. And I think they've been caught out. Ultimately, it's got to be the club's responsibility. Like you said at the start of yourself, well, as a player, if I'm someone coming to me and going, look, I think you're brilliant, I really don't want you to move, but I can't pay you anymore, but I can offer you X, Y, and Z, because I think you should be a part of this club for years to come, you know, years to come on and actually develop the club as a whole, of course you're going to step up and take it. I think it'd be very hard not to.
Mr. Doyle.
That's been going on for a little while, what you said there about getting around a salary cap, isn't it? Over in America, they've got salary caps on a lot of their sports, and they're only allowed to spend a certain amount. But it's about where they do the draft, and it's across the entire region of America. They'll talk about setting themselves up with a house and with a family to start with and things like that. And, you know, they'll be able to put them, they get drivers, they get cars, they get all bits and pieces, and they go under the radar of that salary cap a little bit. And that, again, is it's gamesmanship to a certain extent. It's financial gamesmanship, isn't it? It's bending the rules but not breaking them. And I suppose the question is that okay? Is that all right to do as long as it's within the rules? You get loads of companies who get around sort of tax avoidance in that way, and they can't be done for it necessarily, but they enable themselves to make lots and lots of money and things like that for their owners.
Mr. Tin, I saw you perk up then.
Yeah, so I think it's actually quite interesting, this idea of like the extras. So the things that clubs or, you know, team sports, whatever, might fund to get this player involved, and what isn't maybe perceived as to being like financial doping to buy in your way to success. So it's really interesting with the financial fair play that got brought in with football. It doesn't actually include building new training facilities, stadiums, youth development or women's football. So none of the financial fair play regulations include that. And I find it quite interesting that those things are okay to spend money on. You've got teams like Man City who have actually gone up to their financial fair play limit and beyond it. We'll probably discuss that later. But they've built amazing training facilities, and that's fine.
They've really gone for it on the player side of things as well, because that stadium they inherited actually was from part of the Commonwealth Games. And then they were quite clever. I understand they've written a lot of their debts off to the club sponsors. And according to the like sponsorship league tables, they've got the most sponsorship in world football. All by the company that owned the club, which is a little bit, that's kind of trying to bend the rules and find the loophole to get through. But that's not the fault of the players on the pitch, but the team themselves seem to get quite a bit of stick about it. And obviously they're now sort of being punished by that as well. It just kind of interests that line of how much is that dictating what goes on in sport, Mr. Doyle?
Have you seen the latest thing that's gone on in the Championship in particular has been selling the stadium to the owners of the club in order to get around the FFP for one season? So Derby and Sheffield Wednesday in particular are being looked at the moment, because they sold from the club the rights to their ground and stadium and the land around it to the owners. Technically speaking, nothing changes, so they still play in the same stadium and things like that, but that has given up the entire future of that club. Because if the owners get bored, or the owners decide that they don't want it anymore, or they want to sell it off, then the club doesn't any longer own the biggest thing that they can take loans out against, and, you know, things like that in the future. Financial security has been given up, and all because they've signed too many players, given out too many wages to meet those FFP rules. because they know if they go up to the Premier League, it sorts it all out. They can buy it back again. They can buy, the club can buy the stadium back again. It's a massive, massive gamble with clubs that are hundreds and hundreds of years old.
There's a good, I think it's a good one to have a bit of lockdown viewing on Netflix. Sunderland Till I Die is a really good programme, and it goes right behind the scenes. But I sat there and I was watching episodes and I couldn't believe some of the financial decisions that were being made. You had a club that had gone from the Championship down to League One, and they had players still on £75,000 a week. And the players, rightly, are kind of going to go, I'm not going to release myself from that contract. I'm being paid good money. But they're damaging the club, and it was hard to watch at times.
Yeah, no, I've watched it too, and I loved the series. I thought it was brilliant. And the owners or the chairman, when they come in for the second season of that, they make this big like pledge, basically, cutting costs, reducing everything. They were looking at spreadsheets the whole time. And when push came to shove in the January window, despite trying to cut costs, making people redundant, which obviously no club wants to do, they ended up folding and buying a striker for like three times the amount they initially wanted to. So at what point do we put the emphasis on putting money into the team or prioritising the club, like what Mr. Doyle was saying?
That's where, for me, the American draft system has kind of got it right, because it's a bit more entertaining for the fans as well. If you look at the NBA, you're not going to necessarily know that your team's going to be successful for like 10, 15 years on the spin. You might get a 3-4 year cycle, but because of the draft system, your next player might come through from the college system instead, and it means you've got to be really tight on financial control. You can only have a certain amount of like designated star players. You can only give certain contracts out. That system has meant that the NBA is going to be in sort of financial control for years to come, which I think is a really good system. But I don't know if we could do that in the Premier League in football, for example.
I think it's kind of almost, have we gone too far to now introduce something like that? Would mean, obviously, players, you know, because to be fair, players get paid what they get paid. They've been offered that and they've taken that. And I think with it, like everyone, you live within your means. So they're used to that wage. And so it will be very difficult to start to bring something in which is lowering those wages to get it back to a sense of normality, because actually that's unfair on the players which have been given this. Do you know what I mean?
Mm. No, I understand that.
Again, they talk about that in terms of outsider sports as well. Do you try to make things fairer and better all round? Or does that actually mean that people will leave and go elsewhere where the money's better? You see, again, in terms of business, big companies, you know, there's tax rules that are, you know, pretty unfair to small businesses. Big businesses, they get lots of tax loopholes. But if you take them away, then that means all of those big businesses are going to go to different countries. And it's the same with football players. You know, they were doing a big influx of players over to France in rugby, weren't they? Because there wasn't a salary cap there. But then England have put that rule on to say that you wouldn't play for England if you went over and played in a different country for those reasons. It's like you've got to strike a balance as to whether or not you try to make everything really, really fair and really righteous, or do you allow certain things so that the entertainment value is still there because you've got the very best of the best in your country?
There's one question I wanted to pose to you guys as well. Is do you think that the finances are going to control what sport looks like in our country in the next few weeks and months? How much of it do you think will be decided by the people actually playing the game? Or how much do you think will be driven by the need to get more money back into the sport?
I think it is being driven by the need to get more money back into the sport. I was reading an article earlier, and it was a breakdown of all of the Premier League teams and their stance on going back. And there's so many different views of it. And it looked, there was an article in The Guardian that was about, I think, sport are looking at losing £700 million because of this crisis. And that was a couple of weeks ago. So obviously now it's all been extended again more. So it's going to amount to more. And I do think the financial side of things is what's going to be pushing to open up sport and get it back on. Unfortunately for the players, they might not have a choice. But
Mr. Tierney?
Yeah, I think the sad fact about all of this, and it goes further than sport, is that in times of trouble, there's always an opportunity for someone to make money and succeed in some way. And I think a lot of the TV companies at the minute are seeing that everyone's home, you're all sat down, you're crying out for something, they're going to try and maximise that viewing. And I think, you know, TV audiences, that kind of thing, sponsorships, advertising are going to really dominate sport in the coming days and week months while this is going on.
Mm. Mr. Nash, would you play sport now? If you were a professional and you were asked to go back, could you go in the current climate?
Yeah, 100%. I'll miss it now myself. I'd love to be able to go back and play some sport. But it's the same with, you know, getting back out to work and having things to do. I think if I could go out and play work and play sport, I would indeed. I think obviously a lot of this is going to be driven by the economy as well, isn't it? And I'm not an economist and understand it totally, but ultimately by having sport running, that is going to generate money for the economy as well. People are going to spend the pay-per-view, they're going to spend merchandise again once people are, you know, seeing their sports taking place, and so it's a big part of it. Hence why big things like, you know, moving house now has become something that can happen during lockdown, yet you still can't go and see your mums and dads and your family. You can have strangers come to your house, very odd, but ultimately it boils down to money for the economy, is what I think.
It's going to be an interesting time, and I think the finances in sport are going to change dramatically over the next season as well. Be interesting to see how many sponsors can keep up the money they've been ploughing into it, how many players, how much they change and challenge and go, like, transfer and different things. It's going to be a big watch over the next few months, I think, which will make it interesting on a different level. Should we look on to our next topic, which we're going to look a bit about choking. Do you want to introduce it, Mr. Doyle?
Yeah, so we like to link in, don't we, to what we're currently studying for our Key Stage 5 students. So at the minute, we're looking at exploring psychological skills, ways of being able to deal with psychological issues that arise during performance. And what I want to do is I want to set the scene for you for this one. I particularly usually use football as an example, so I've tried to go away. So from this one, we're looking at the 2021 now Olympics, right? Imagine, put yourself in the position that you are an Olympic diver. You're going up to the 10-metre platform and you got into a situation where you've got a full-packed arena and you're about to do the biggest dive of your life. And as you're going up and you're approaching the area, you've been through it before, you know that you've got the ability to win gold, you know that technically you're sound. However, what runs through your mind? And we're talking about choking on this one. We're talking about sort of anxiety, fears, things that are cognitive, things that go on in your mind, there may be negative thoughts about how well you're going to do, but also things that happen to the body, which is the somatic anxiety as well. So it could be possibly butterflies, the shakes, muscle tension occurring in the wrong places. What do you do at the point where you're about to jump to deal with those things before you actually go and take the plunge, if you like?
Honestly, I can only think of that John Smith advert where he did a running bomb into the diving pool. And that was the only thing going through my mind at that stage. I think
cannonball!
That was all I was thinking of doing. And just thinking about that put the frighteners up me, so that wouldn't be the one for me, I don't think.
Well, has anybody got any ideas of techniques that they might have trained themselves to be able to use, or examples of where they've heard of those things being used? Ways of calming yourself down, lowering anxiety in that situation?
Go on, Mr. Tinney. Thank you. The one that springs to my mind is, I think, to actually build on what Miss Green's favourite sporting moment was, you think about like Johnny Wilkinson, when he used to kick, he used to say he was trying to visualise kicking the ball into the lap of someone behind the post. So maybe if you're using a bit of visualisation to execute what the perfect dive would look like, maybe the diver would use that. I'm not saying I do that myself, that I'm horrific when it comes to the pressure being on.
Now, I love that bit of imagery, which is good. Miss Green?
Yeah, very similar. Mental rehearsal, you know. You're stepping up on that board, but actually you've done that dive thousands of times probably in training, in different, you know, in a more comfortable situation. And it's just about taking yourself back to actually when you're in training and you're doing it for the 15th time in a day and you've smashed it 10 times out of the 15. That's where I am. That's what I'm going to do, and try and block everything else out, I guess, and just think, I can do this, I've done this before, let's go.
Fantastic. Mr. Nash, did you have one there as well?
I think I was going to agree with what they're saying. I think mental rehearsal is really important. I use it myself in my own sport. I'll do the night before I'm about to play sport, I'll start thinking about what it might look like, what I might be doing, what positions I'll be getting myself into in the game that I'm playing, and so on. And then when you start to experience it on the day, it gives you that feeling of, oh yeah, I can do this. It's a real positive buzz. One other thing I use to help me calm myself down is set myself targets throughout the game. So it might be, playing rugby, for instance, that I'm going to make 15 decent passes within the first 10 minutes or whatever it might be. And then as I do that, again, I start to feel better. But there's times when it all goes wrong, and then I have to sort of rethink at the moment, how am I going to calm myself down? Because the first several passes I've done have gone skyrocketing and everyone's missed them. So how do I get that right? But I always use that in my own sport.
That's absolutely great. And in terms of the skills that people can use, obviously we're talking about anxiety being a problem here. And the different skills you can use, you've already talked about goal setting in particular and influencing your motivation in that way. And we've talked about imagery and mental rehearsal, which is fantastic. What about, though, if your mindset is actually really positive? Maybe you've used a bit of self-talk, which is another strategy that you could potentially use. And your confidence is actually sky high. But the anxiety doesn't actually then go towards what's going on in your mind, and it goes towards what's going on in your body. I've found this happen a couple of times. I'm generally quite a positive person, but when I did my I've used this example a couple of times, when I did my driving test, I suddenly found that as I put my foot on the clutch, this was my first test, that my foot was shaking uncontrollably. I felt very fine and calm and nervous, not nervous, but when it came to my foot, I was getting a somatic anxiety. Now imagine you go up onto that platform, and actually all of a sudden you can feel yourself shaking, and you go, hold on, I've done this a million times, this is great, but you feel those kind of things in. Is there anything that you might think about using then to try and calm the body down rather than the mind?
There was one I'd love to have used, but I actually didn't, and I was playing golf. I was playing at Woburn, and we were approaching another group in front of us, and the people said, oh, do you want to play through us? And I was like, not my preferred option, but I'll do it. And as I turned, it was one of the women from the Solheim Cup team. She was on a practice round. And so I found myself having to try and drive a golf ball in front of this woman that's a million times better than me, about to go and represent Europe in a sporting competition. I couldn't even feel my hands. I didn't know what I was doing. And I would have quite happily just thrown the golf ball and just moved away from it. And I just lost all body control during that moment. And the thing I should have done was just blocked her out. I should have just blocked the whole thing out and just really tried to strip it down to the most basic thing. Try and imagine yourself back on a driving range when you're doing your routine. I couldn't do it. And all I could think of was, there's a professional stood next to me, I'm about to hit her in the face.
Yeah. I think with the somatics, I think it's often quite difficult to overcome something there and then when it's physical. I think a lot of it still comes from your mental state, and so calming yourself down again in your head. There's stuff you can do like relaxation techniques, so you can start to kind of tense and calm parts of your body, but that's all stuff that takes quite a long time, and you wouldn't necessarily want to stand at the top of the diving board for 3, 4, 5 minutes doing that. Breathing, I think, is a good one. Regrouping and calming your breathing down and focusing on that, because then that will automatically give you a focus on, and then hopefully help the rest of your body stop shaking. Because I do also get my hand, if I'm talking in front of people, my hand literally goes mental and I can't stop it, and I'm absolutely fine talking in front of people, but my hand is just shaking. So I know that feeling.
That's great techniques, Mr. Nash.
That's good. Talk similar to what the screen was talking about, that idea of breathing techniques to help us relax. But one of the proven things to be ready for something is to practice it again and again and again, so that when you get to that main competition point, you're ready and prepared for it, and in your head you are in the right zone, you can do this. And looking at Mr. Southall's example, it's not every day that you will be here in front of somebody of that level, that calibre of player. But if you were to experience that on a daily basis, and you were working within a team of people that are that level, and you are having to do it every day, over time it would get easier to the point where you would ignore and be able to block out. And you think of top level athletes, ultimately that's what they're trying to do, to block out. And the example you used at the beginning about Johnny Wilkinson giving him something to focus on, when you've got 80,000 fans in the stadium, yes, they're being quiet for that kick, there's so much distraction and there's so much pressure upon you. So ultimately, I think in Johnny Wilkinson's autobiography or something I remember watching about Johnny Wilkinson, the reason he could do it so successfully is because in his head he knew he had practiced hundreds and hundreds of times a day. It was just repeating something. It's said within basketball as well, isn't it, that these basketball players who can shoot three-pointers from wherever, it's not just luck. It's because they've been out there shooting 1,000 shots a day for, you know, 10 years, and that's why they can do it.
The hardest thing in training to replicate is the pressure that you would get on the day. And arguably, you can't really do that. But yeah, I completely agree with you. If you know in your own mind, if you've got that confidence that you've been through the same thing over and over again, and all you've got to do is just replicate what you've done almost a million times before, then it takes you that step closer to not getting into that choking situation, doesn't it? The mind does funny, funny things. Mr. Tierney, have you ever tried to do anything prior to an event? I know you used to be a bit of a swimmer. Did you ever feel nerves, or did you ever do something prior to an activity to get yourself into the mindset maybe an hour or two before or something?
Maybe not so much the hour or two before. Like with swimming, there's a bit of a build-up. Obviously, you go through like the marshal area and you come down to the race. I always used to have a routine of like the order in which I'd put my goggles and my hat on. And it sounds weird, I know. And then also, kind of like a big deep breath. It sounds a bit bizarre, and you look like a bit of a nutter when you do it, if I'm honest. But like, stood behind the block, like a big deep breath, and like, you can do this. It's a bit of a leveller. Always used to help me out, and I much like Miss Green, would be shaking a lot before that, but it kind of just settles the nerves a little bit for me.
Yeah, the thing where you say, in that way, you look like a bit of a nutter.
Yeah.
That I mean, in general, that's exactly what sports psychologists are involved now in training to try to get people out of that mindset. These are as good techniques as drill work is to improve your skills. And these techniques are kind of, they're proven to work. You do need to have a certain type of personality for it. And it might be that you're flogging a dead horse a little bit with somebody who's really, really extroverted and trying to get them to do maybe some relaxation techniques or progressive muscular relaxation, things like that. So there is something that you need to have a little look into as to whether or not someone's got the mindset for it. But if you can train and use those techniques, such as what we've said, relaxation through breathing, which can be done on the spot when you go up to that diving platform, or the progressive muscular relaxation that can go on beforehand. We also have talked previously about dartitis and about hypnosis and ways in which you're able to combat sort of odd things that happen with your body by using autogenic techniques and hypnosis and things like that. It's about selecting the right thing, training as much as you can beforehand to be able to put it into practice at the right times. But, you know, I think one thing that we've got to be clear on is, as much training as you do, choking can happen to the very, very best athletes. It's not something that you can completely eradicate from your game, but you can prepare yourself more to be able to use it.
Yeah, no, definitely. I was gonna jump in and kind of use a bit of an example there. You were saying, Mr. Doyle, there, that when someone has practiced so much, and that when we initially discussed the idea of choking in sport, the idea that, and the example that came to my mind was Jordan Spieth at the Masters a couple of years ago. He was looking robotic. He was so good all the way up to it, and on the final round, around Amen Corner, the last couple of holes, he just fell apart. You know, he was the best player in the world and on that course by a long way, but doesn't matter how much practice he had done, he choked in that sporting environment and essentially handed the win to someone else.
McIlroy's dropped a massive lead in more recent years as well, hasn't he? Like a huge lead for him.
I think it looked, because you get to a point when you're so far in front, you think, I'm going to win this, and then you start thinking about picking up the trophy and you start thinking about what I'm going to spend the first paycheck on, and for a lot of those guys, that's like their first win or first sort of 2-3 wins. You can get a bit ahead of yourself. And I think that's one thing to look at when you look at these types of techniques is The Last Dance on Netflix, which I am like gripped by. It's an incredible program. And if you're not watching it, like, it is genuinely one of the best ones to watch. Watching somebody like Michael Jordan, who he missed a few sort of game-winning shots here or there, but good, man. He made up for him like the following year. It was incredible.
I think that's it. And when we're talking about what you would do if you were a McIlroy in that situation, or a Spieth, or a, you know, a Jordan in that situation, I think for our year 12s, to bring it back to what they're working on at the minute, is figure out what it is. What psychological factor is it? Is it motivation because you're already in the clubhouse, you know, sipping on your first, you know, lemonade because you want to celebrate? Is it that? Is it motivation? And if so, select the right tool. Select the goal setting. Those little targets that we were talking about. Is it that actually you've got the shakes, it's somatic, it's anxiety that's affecting you at that point in time? Well, if that's the case, look at your breathing techniques, because goal setting is not going to work on that. Is it something that you're getting het up about beforehand? If so, then you've got another selection of tools in your armory to use. So it's about making sure you know what they are, in which situations they would be able to be used, how can you incorporate them into a training routine, and actually how can they affect the psychological factor that is affecting you at that point in time. And I think if students are able to make those distinctions, then they're onto a winner with their coursework.
That feels like quite a natural place to kind of stop things for this week, which would be a good one to do. I think if you, for homework for next week, you've got to watch that one on Netflix, That Last Dance. That is going to be used for years to come. I think it is the number one trending program on Netflix at the moment, so that's definitely worth a watch. We'll do like a group goodbye, I suppose, rather than going around everybody individually, and we'll see everybody next week.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye guys. Thank you.